This is Melissa, and today is the 10th of November, 2024. And some of you have asked about my Aunt Betty, and I appreciate that, and so does she. And I wanted to let you know that about a week and a half ago, she had a pacemaker put in. And that procedure seems to have been a success, and she's feeling pretty well. I took her yesterday just on some fun errands, and we had a little bite to eat. I've taken her to two doctor's appointments in the last week and a half as follow-up. She was a 2 days and a night at the hospital. She put off the cardiologist as the last possible thing that she wanted to look into. She said, when it's your heart, it's always, that's the end. So I said, look, if it's a heart issue, this is one of the simplest ones. There's no open heart surgery. There's no stents. There's no valves. You know, it's pretty straightforward, but she's recovering well. Thank you. Also, I'm disappointed because I expected my flash drives to be here on the 11th. Well, actually, the 11th is a holiday, but on the 12th, that was their due date for getting here. And then I could start sending them out. But the manufacturing company wants to have one more step, which involves, I believe they shipped them out yesterday, and I will be looking at them again to sign off on something. They call this live samples. So it's a step, but it probably adds 5 or 6 days, so I don't think I'll be sending these out until the 18th. But I have written out your envelope if you ordered them. I've got an envelope with your name on it, and they're ready to go, but delayed by about a week. So apologies for that. I'm excited, and I appreciate your orders. I also wanted to mention the book club upcoming on the 16th. Andrea and Fiona are going to lead a talk on Chapter 16, The New Age. So that is the 16th Saturday. They've got it down here at 1900. I think that might have changed. I think we might be at 1800 UK time. But I will scrounge around for a visual and let you know about that. But that's Saturday in the Telegram Book Club site. And then in December, Rob from the group and I are going to cover Chapter 17, The Nuclear Rivalry in the Cold War, American Atomic Supremacy, 1945 to 1950. There are three more chapters remaining after that. We hope to cover Chapter 18 in January and then Chapter 19 and 20 in February. And if there are any of you who would like to either handle a chapter on your own or do a chapter with me or with Darren, just let us know. You can contact Darren or Andrea in the Telegram Book Club site, or you can contact me. We would just love to have you involved if you're interested. The redux that I picked for today is an interview that Alan had with someone named Kevin Smith, and this was April the 19th, 2006. It was the 2 hour, actually probably each so-called hour was more like 45 minutes. And what I've done is I've taken the first segment and then about 10 minutes of the second segment where there's a caller and they continue thematically what they were discussing in the first hour. I have run this through several different filters to improve the sound. And I am sometimes when I do that, I think, oh, if you listen to it with a headset, it's not bad. But in this particular case, I think it's better not to have the headset on. The host is the one with the more problematic audio sound. Alan's wasn't bad, but the host has a little bit of feedback and just kind of noise there. But fortunately, Alan does most of the talking. So it's a talk really worth hearing. Alan, the host, Kevin Smith, and I don't think he's on the go anymore, and he was fairly, I don't want to say he was old then, but it was 19 years ago now almost, and I'm not sure that he is with us any longer, but his site is not up. And his focus was mostly covering UFOs and aliens and things in that vein. And I think Alan might have been a bit of a departure for him. He introduced him as having some really far-out ideas about history, but well worth hearing. And it made me think, you know, in a way, yes, Alan did have some far-out ideas about history, not just the things that we take for granted that he said, but I think one of the key things that he differs from other historians and thinkers on is the age of the world that we inhabit. And he believes that it is very old. And so he's explaining to the host this ancient system, the mystery schools, how the mystery schools work, and the perennial religion. Now, just coincidentally, I stopped by the Tragedy and Hope Book Club chat channel on Telegram today, and they were discussing some quotes from a redux that I had put up in the middle of September, redux number 178. I don't have the title in front of me, sorry, but they were discussing some things that Alan had said again about the age of the system and so forth. And so I went back and looked at that transcript because it tied right in with the talk I'm putting up today. Alan said to Jackie, "As I say, it's a much older religion than people realize because this was taught to all the Greek aristocracy when they were all sent to study in Egypt. And Pythagoras came back with that philosophy and the goal of the great work. And of course, he started up with their own little schools, and these schools all led the youth to revolution. Therefore, this would be done through revolution down through the ages, and it's still going on. What I'm saying is this is a much older religion than what people think. It pre-existed Judaism. It ran through Babylon and Egypt. All the Greek aristocrats and philosophers studied in Egypt and then were sent out after their initiation to start up schools for youth. And each school that they set up became a place of admission, a monastery, you might say. And what they were taught is how to go out into the world and create revolution. Egypt was teaching revolution to these initiates, like Pythagoras, for instance." Jackie said, "When you say revolutions, are you talking like American Revolution, Russian Revolution, all the revolutions?" And Alan said, "All the revolutions, yes." And Jackie said, "Well, of course, the elders of the Jews say they were behind all the revolutions." And Alan said, "Well, maybe they claim that, but I think that's a boast." I don't want to use the word jaywalker here. I just want to say Jews and Jewish and Judaism. I want to say Israel. So when I post this on channels that have a hyperactive AI, I will probably bleep them out some way and cover that up. But this is what I'm talking about. To emphasize that is because of a news story that I saw today that caught my attention, and also because of an exchange that I had with someone that is a long time listener, many, many years listener to Alan. And I had been discussing an interaction that I had had with someone about Judaism and their defense of it, and my really just repeating what Alan said about all religions being created and used for control. This longtime listener is, he lives in Australia. That is not where he's from, but he lives in Australia, and he is Jewish in that that is his family heritage. And so there's always been that, are we looking at a religion or are we looking at a people, a race of people? So that question has never really been satisfactorily answered. But he wrote to me, I've been pretty much disowned, shunned, made an outcast and an untouchable to my family and the Jewish community for having three Gentile children with my Gentile English wife in New Zealand. And because of her failure to convert to Judaism and or to raise my children Jewish. He said that an Orthodox cousin of his said to him on a trip to Israel in the late 90s, you brought Goyim into the world, and if any of them should kill a Jew, it'll be on your head. So the question he was asking, and then, you know, in a subsequent email, perhaps even answering, but the question he was asking is, what are these people? Who are these people? And he said, there's no mystery why they've been booted out of these countries for the past 2,000 years. If he looks at his own family and the bulk of the Jewish community, he said, the mystery is that it hasn't happened more and harder. He asks, are they resonating with the formative morphogenic field of Jewishness? Morphogenic is how you are changed, how cells are changed. So it comes from the Greek morphe, shape, and Genesis, creation, the generation of form. And here is how Wiki defines morphogenesis, the biological process that causes a cell, tissue, or organism to develop its shape. It is one of three fundamental aspects of developmental biology, along with the control of tissue growth and patterning of cellular differentiation. So it is in the formative stage, the embryonic stage of a cell. So back to his question, he said, are they resonating with the formative morphogenic field of Jewishness, the people themselves? Is there a field where the cell is formed? He goes on to write that there's a long history of Talmudic channeling and conjuring of demons, their association with golems. The rabbis summon demons from the demonic realm, and some of them are demons themselves. So he then said, if you call yourself a Jew, you could actually be resonating with that and being possessed by these morphogenic forces. He then goes on to ponder, maybe anyone who identifies as a Jew falls under the spell of occult, Kabbalistic, and Talmudic black magic and demonology and golem creation. Maybe that's what's going on in the Holy Land right now. Just a big occult ritual satanic sacrifice. He said it's certainly nothing no right-thinking person ought to be dabbling in. Now, I'm just putting that out there. I'm not saying that I agree. But this conversation seems to be where they want people to go right now. And so we ask ourselves the question, why? Why? The news story that caught my attention was this, a pogrom. This is how the New York Post described it. Only four anti-Israel Amsterdam pogrom attackers remain in custody after 63 were detained. Only four of those arrested in connection with the horrific attacks on Israeli soccer fans in Amsterdam were still in custody Saturday, even as Dutch authorities said they are now probing if they missed warning signs of potential violence highlighted by Israel in the days before the chaos. There were 63 people detained following the Thursday night horror when gangs of anti-Israel mobs viciously set upon Maccabi Tel Aviv soccer fans as they were leaving a Europa League match. Now, one of the things that I saw again in the CTTM book club site, and I am not sure I have it up here, I might, was a news story that said they used the number 33 twice for no reason, and they did. They identified one of the victims as a 33-year-old, and then they identified him again as being 33. So it's one of those things that once you see it, you always notice that kind of thing. So what happened is Israeli soccer fans were attacked by anti-Israel rioters in Amsterdam Thursday night following a match. Israeli officials said 10 citizens were injured. Up to 10 were at one point out of contact with their families, but by 3 p.m. Friday, all were accounted for following the hours of overnight violence, apparently perpetrated largely by local Muslims and Arabs. Hundreds more people huddled in their hotels for hours, fearing they could be attacked again when trying to reach their flights home. Now, I'm not seeing it here, but somewhere I saw that Israel had sent a rescue plane to pick up the Israelis. But according to the same listener who just gave me that description, the violence, the attack was actually started by the Israeli soccer fans. And this is how he described it. He said, as for the, quote, pogrom in Amsterdam, it turns out the Israeli soccer fans' goons were the aggressors and started the whole thing. He said the other side needs to be deported and banned from entering the country again, while the Israelis need to be evacuated to Israel for their salvation from the evil anti-Semites. So that was his response. I sent him back something which I am about to share with you, and that is the description as it appeared in Wikipedia. Now, we know about Wikipedia, but this is actually some pretty interesting coverage here. On 7 November, following a UEFA Europa League football match in Amsterdam, Netherlands, between Israeli club Maccabi Tel Aviv. Look up Maccabi if you want to know about that revolutionary. And Dutch club AFC Ajax, a Greek god, Maccabi Tel Aviv fans were targeted in a series of attacks. Maccabi Tel Aviv fans were filmed beforehand burning a Palestinian flag, chanting anti-Arab slurs, and not observing a moment of silence for the victims of the 2024 Spanish floods. Okay, 200 and some Spanish people died in some floods last month, and they were having a moment of silence at the games. The Israelis did not observe that moment of silence. According to Wikipedia, the Israeli fans were filmed before the game started, burning a Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Arab slurs. And it goes on to give a very large description of the anti-Semitism that has gone on because of the Israel-Hamas war, etc. But one thing that was really interesting to me is that this is the other side, okay? So the Israelis were the Maccabi Tel Aviv in this soccer match. But the other soccer team were called the AFC Ajax. Here's the Jewish connection, according to Wiki. Historically, Ajax was popularly seen as having Jewish roots, while it had fewer Jewish players than WVHEDW, Ajax had a Jewish image since the 1930s, when the home stadium was located next to a Jewish neighborhood of Amsterdam Oost, and opponents saw many supporters walking through a neighborhood, which I don't want to slaughter. The term is the Jews' Corner to get to the stadium. The city of Amsterdam was historically referred to as a Mokum city, Mokum being the Yiddish word for place or safe haven. And as anti-Semitic chants and name-calling developed and intensified at the old Demir Stadium, the Ajax fans, and it said few of them were actually Jewish, responded by embracing Ajax's historic Jewish identity. So the fans themselves started calling themselves Super Jews, and they would chant Jews, Jews, or Joden, Joden at the games, and they adopted Jewish symbols such as the Star of David and the Israeli flag. At one point, they would sing Hava Nagila, the Hebrew folk song. So this is their identity from the 1930s, going on, really gaining steam in the 1980s. It said fans of Ajax's rivals escalated their anti-Semitic rhetoric, chanting slogans like Hamas, Hamas, Jews to the gas. So if we want to rhyme it, maybe they were saying Hamas, Hamas, Jews to the gas. Hissing to imitate the flow of gas, giving Nazi salutes and other things. The eventual result was that many genuinely Jewish Ajax fans stopped going to games. So in the 2000s, the club began to try to persuade their fans to drop this Jewish image, but it still persists. And this is the lore or the background of this soccer team. So what you have here is the Israeli, you know, soccer hooliganism is not a new thing, right? Is this soccer hooliganism? Or was this genuine anti-Semitic pogrom? One thing, though, is clear. Even Wikipedia seems to point to the idea that the Israeli fans had not behaved. Now, they even sent IDF along with the Israeli team because they were on high alert. And you'd think that if you were on high alert, there might be a message sent out to your fans, you know, cool it, let's chill out here. But they were doing what I'm asking, the question I'm asking, because I don't know, was this anti-Semitic pogrom behavior, or was this soccer hooliganism? What was on my mind after listening to this was men who would be gods and revolutionaries. Men who would be gods, because Alan really stresses here, it's a whole different religion. They've got a religion, then they give us our religions. And I think it is so helpful to see these people for who they are or who they might be. And this longtime listener to Alan, some of his questions may make you very uncomfortable. But if we can't ask the questions, how do we understand what we're looking at ever? And the dialogue, as we know, is shut down and shut down hard, most of the time through self-censorship. But I'm suggesting that the questions have to be asked in a different background, in a different way, because if it is the constant, what really is anti-Semitic? It's the Jews. The Jews did this. The Jews did that. Jew, 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 Jew. Then we are failing to understand the ancientness of a system. And as Alan said to Jackie, this predates Judaism. So I started thinking about Trump, now the president-elect, and everyone who is around him, the kind of pantheon of the gods. And the first was that came to mind was the kind of recent sidekick, Elon Musk, that endorsed him and hung out at some of his rallies, our new champion of free speech. And when I look at Elon Musk, it's hard for me to see a god. It's hard for me to even make up which god he might be. And as I was pondering this, considering which god is Elon Musk, the only thing that came into my mind was Puck. And Puck is really a domestic or a nature sprite, like a little fairy. Hardly a god. A fairy, a mischievous spirit, sprite. But that's what I see when I see Elon Musk. And another name for Puck is Robin Goodfellow. So you can look into this. All of this mythology, Puck featured in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, is again the mischievous sprite. But I was reading a little bit about who had mentioned Puck in history, and it kind of made me laugh when I learned that Robin Goodfellow appears in an 1856 speech by Karl Marx, who said, "In the signs that bewilder the middle class, the aristocracy, and the poor prophets of regression, we recognize our brave friend, Robin Goodfellow, the old mole that can work the earth so fast, that worthy pioneer, the revolution, with a capital R." So to Karl Marx, Robin Goodfellow, a.k.a. Puck, personified revolution. So I continued on down the pantheon of gods. And who else is beside Donald Trump now? Well, there's RFK Jr., the Falconer. So maybe he's Horus, the protector of the Pharaoh. There is Trump's vice president-elect, J.D. Vance, and his wife, Usha. Usha is a Hindu goddess. So I looked up Usha, and she was the name, she's a goddess, the goddess of dawn, I think, the early morning light. And she was married. She was the daughter of a demon king, and she was married to the grandson of Krishna, who is sometimes called the avatar of Krishna. Her parents come from the Brahmin class. Are you surprised? I'm not. Now, J.D. Vance is Peter Thiel's boy of Palantir, and I've talked about him. I have talked about Palantir in the as part of the military industrial complex. Palantir is a company that specializes in software platforms for big data analytics. Founded in 2003 by Peter Thiel, Stephen Cohen, Joe Lonsdale, and Alex Karp, the name is derived from the Lord of the Rings, where the magical Palantiri were seeing stones, described as indestructible balls of crystal used for communication and to see events in other parts of the world. This is CIA, military industrial complex, huge. Here is Alex Karp. I haven't talked that much about Alex Karp except to say he just gave me the creeps. But I'll speak to him a little bit more. Peter Thiel, I don't know what god he is. Some god of wealth or homosexuals. I don't know. I'll let you play with that one. Alex Karp is the CEO. He's called outspoken, kind of strange, brash, et cetera, et cetera. But he got a PhD in philosophy. And this one, if we want to talk revolutionaries, really gave me pause. What I'm telling you is these people are never who we are told they are. You know, I heard someone, who was it? Bill Maher, who's really a comedian who fancies himself to be an intellectual, describe Elon Musk as not only the richest man in the world, but, you know, possibly the smartest man in the world. And I was wondering to myself what his agent had how his agent had negotiated. You know, every time Bill Maher calls him the smartest guy in the world, does he get $100,000 or $500,000? Yeah. But I think that's how it works. So Alex Karp is a billionaire, and he's the CEO of Palantir, and his middle name is Cadman. And Cadman, interestingly, speaking of monasteries that Alan talks about in this, was the cowherd for a monastery known as Whitby Abbey in the 6th century, I guess. And he is known as the first English poet and a monk. So that's quite the middle name to live up to. But when you look at Alex Karp, it talks about how he got his PhD in philosophy. He's a self-described socialist. His parents took him to labor rights demonstrations as a child. But he inherited some money from his grandfather. It sparked an interest in investing. So what I'm telling you right now, this is a mythology. This is foundational mythology. He inherited money from his grandfather. It sparked an interest in investing. He created a London-based firm called Cadman Group, named after his middle name, investing on behalf of high net worth clients. Now, he was a classmate of Peter Thiel. This is PayPal guy. What guy out of school just finds themselves investing on behalf of high net worth clients? See, things like this don't just happen. He's called eccentric. He has 10 mansions, but he says think of them as just 10 huts for my cross-country skiing, little changing huts. That's what they are. He said the thought of having a family gives him the hives. The only time he doesn't think about work is when he's doing his qigong or having sex. So this is the guy that kind of gives me the creeps. But he is super pro-Israel and so proud of how helpful Palantir has been to Israel. And he's had some employees leave his company because of his outspoken defense of Israel. And he said, that's just the way it's going to be. Recently, a Norwegian firm disinvested from Palantir because of their helpfulness. Storebrand said no more. We don't want any more Palantir stocks. They stated in the announcement that Palantir's products supported Israeli surveillance of Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and were used to identify individuals who are likely to launch lone wolf terrorist attacks, facilitating their arrests preemptively before the strikes that it is projected they would carry out. Palantir develops software products, but it operates as an integrator, tailoring a solution for each customer. This is, again, like I said, a really good talk from Alan, a good interview that he does. I will be sure to include the link to the full transcript, the link to the original two audios so that you can hear that. My point in raising up the specter of Judaism and running the risk of being called anti this or that is actually just the opposite. What I'm trying to show you is that we've got a pantheon of gods around our so-called elected officials. They have an agenda, and I think the agenda is revolution. One interesting little tidbit of information about Alex Karp. He did his doctoral thesis in German at Goethe University in Frankfurt. And I don't speak German. I can't give you the title in German, but it translates to English. Aggression in Lived World Experience, the extension of Parsons' concept of aggression by describing the connection between jargon, aggression, and culture. Parsons was an American sociologist. This is in the neoclassical social theory. If you like academia, knock yourselves out on this one. But here's the little interesting tidbit I wanted to share. When he was doing his doctoral dissertation, he was initially to be advised by Jürgen Habermas. But there was a disagreement regarding the dissertation topic, and so he switched advisors. So I think what I'm describing here are revolutionaries. Alex Karp is one. His former didn't quite get to be advisor was one, Jürgen Habermas. Here's Jürgen Habermas, associated with the Frankfurt School. His work focuses on the foundations of epistemology and social theory. Goes on to give his background, and Jürgen Habermas had a falling out. He studied philosophy and sociology under the critical theorists Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno at Goethe University's Frankfurt Institute for Social Research. Now, don't you think it's interesting that Alex Karp of Palantir decided, an American, that he was going to go get his PhD at Goethe University, Frankfurt, and study with people in a direct line from the Frankfurt School? What we are looking at are men who would be gods and revolutionaries. Just take in a little bit of the gossip that you can pick up on Dr. Alex Karp or Peter Thiel. Just try to imagine yourself briefly in their world with their money, who their lovers are, and how they spend their time. Maybe one of them should be called Narcissus, I don't know. But we're definitely looking at people who are not like us. It's a different class altogether. All right, enjoy this talk and have a good week.
So, Alan, thank you and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
It's a pleasure.
You have kind of a, I don't want to say it's a strange view of the world. It's not that it's strange, but it's that you have a view that is different from the mainstream, and it's quite a bit different. A lot of people around the world right now are sort of in that situation. They really don't see something, and they haven't heard, and they don't smell anything, but lots of people are beginning to sense something's up.
Oh, yes.
And,
yeah, something definitely is up. It's almost a hush before the storm. There's a hush of expectation. And there's been such a hype, mind you, of I call it terror creation in the people's minds to get them into something so that they will react and go the way they're planned to go. That's generally why fear and terror is used by from the top down. That's the standard down through the ages. It brings into mind, actually, Professor Carol Quigley, who was the historian for the Council on Foreign Relations. And he was in the record-keeping department, or histories, and he was updating their histories for them and filing them. And from that, he wrote a book called The Anglo-American Establishment. And he talks about how the Council on Foreign Relations, the British set, in British Commonwealth countries, they're called Institutes of International Affairs. and every Commonwealth country, including Canada, has one. Non-Commonwealth countries have council and foreign relations. India has one too, and Pakistan. He talks about how the government hyped up the British public for 3 or 4 years prior to World War II to get them all sort of ready for the war. And they had board meetings with the big newspaper corporations of London, who were all members of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and they agreed to panic the people by putting out false data, propaganda, on an increasing drumbeat right up for 2 or 3 years on the go. And they told them nothing but lies, and Quigley, who has the records, talks about this being discussed at the round tables in London with the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and they agreed to constantly tell the people in all the newspapers that Hitler had all this gas ready to gas everybody in Britain. And they had, millions of tons of it. And sure enough, they gave everybody a gas mask, and children had them, and they made that practice rehearsals in school and putting them on, something like they did during the Cold War, children get under the table. It was to keep it fresh in your memory. And then of course, they even asked King George to make a speech to the public to tell them to start digging trenches in major cities. This is so it would seem more visual to them. The trenches would be of no use at all, of course, in an air raid. But they kept up this hype and fear, and they even started evacuating children up into Scotland from the major cities. And again, at that time, the war was still 3 years away, and it split the families up and made it seem all so real, so that by the time, with all this hype, oh, you're going to get gassed at any minute, when they eventually said, we're going to war with Germany, the people who were so tensed up and panicked breathed a sigh of relief.
Yeah,
and that is
yeah.
how psychological warfare works on entire populations.
This is not something new, though, is it?
It's a standard technique.
Been going on, actually, for millennia.
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. But what really kind of piqued my interest was the fact that this is not new. It's been going on for millennia. And you talk about how the ancient civilizations were manipulated by occult managers.
Oh, yeah.
And can you kind of take us back in time and give us a little bit of a history lesson about that? What do you mean when you say that they were managed by these occult people?
Well, I think the masters of it, who left more records of the techniques, were the Egyptians and the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
And Egypt took every pharaoh, for instance, and trained him in the art of government, the sciences of government, they called it, and to the mysteries of government. These were the hidden sciences of basically human mass psychology. And interestingly enough, later the Greek nobility, such as Plato and Democritus and all the big boys, Socrates, Pythagoras, they all were sent to Egypt to enter the mysteries. It would take them 22 years there generally to learn all the mysteries. And then they were sent back to their own countries. Sometimes they had to move on. Plato went to the mysteries there. He was then sent to the mystery school in Palestine and then to one in India and then back to Greece. So this is a lot of learning.
And what was the purpose for that?
Well, what they learned, when you look at what came out of Egypt, was revolution. Because from the days of even Pythagoras, who studied there, and he was sent back to the Grecian colonies. Now, they had a big empire at that time, and he was sent to Crotona, where he set up a mystery school, the standard mystery school. These mystery schools had so much in common with the later Catholic monasteries. It's quite amazing. Because, and you see it 2,000 years ago in Palestine, where the Essenes were. They're all the same, really, with techniques. Pythagoras would recruit young aristocratic students. he actually took in male and female, separate quarters, of course, but they had to have 5 years of silence. That was standard. And they had to watch, look, and listen. Eventually, some of them were picked to go higher. Some of the young ladies were trained in with a tremendous education to be good marriageable partners for the nobility. And then they were basically taken out and introduced to higher members of the existing powers, existing establishments. And the whole idea was to start swaying decisions made in those governments. And when this was found out, what it was really all about, the form of revolution, they turned on Pythagoras and burned down his school and chased him off, and it's undecided whether he was killed or not. But that was the same thing that happened ultimately to Socrates. Now, Socrates, who'd also been trained in Egypt and said a lot of wise things, as they all have very wise sayings, he was accused of corrupting the youth. And what they really meant was he was doing the same thing as Pythagoras. He was recruiting young nobility and training them in a new way of living. You might call it a new world order of the time. And training them up to revolutionaries and also to enter governments and take over those governments and then take a particular agenda forward, which was to create wars upon other countries and take them over one by one into world empire.
Well, who was behind that? I mean, you've got Socrates and Pythagoras and Plato and all those guys being sent to these to study these mysteries. Who is behind it? Who sent them?
They were sent by the masters back in Egypt. Egypt exported revolution. That's what exported. And all the ones who came there to be initiated were being trained to go back to their former countries, set up these schools in preparation for revolution. And Plato wrote about it. And Plato actually was chased off too. He disappeared for years after his teacher Socrates had to drink the hemlock. And so he disappeared and eventually came back and repented and started up his school, but he was no sooner there than he was starting the same old thing all over again. And Plato wrote the book called The Republic.
Right.
And The Republic, of course, was about a future utopia to come. A utopia where an intelligentsia, they called it the natural aristocracy, would rule. Almost a scientific system. But at the top of them would be the guardians, a guardian class, the guardians of the world, and the guardians of the system. And Plato said, he said, you know, man is infinitely malleable. He can adapt to anything so quickly. And because of that ability, man could be made to adapt to a series of adaptations leading to a perfect new type of creature. And he said, we already have domesticated animals for thousands of years. And if we want a small domesticated dog, he says, we create one by selective breeding. If we want the same thing to get a big dog, we again select the dogs, interbreed them till we get the perfect dog. He said, humans are the same. We can do the same with humans and create really tall, long ones if we wanted people to pick apples. Or short, not too bright ones, because they don't want people to rebel, of course. So make short ones for mining and doing all the heavy work and labor. And when you realize what he was talking about was a science that he was not inventing or discovering, he was simply repeating what they already knew in Egypt for thousands of years and had been doing.
What's interesting about what you're saying here is that it sounds very much like what the ancient Sumerians said about the Anunnaki. Are you familiar with that?
Not really. The Anunnaki has nothing to do with what people have recently been flooded with.
Well, what they said was the Anunnaki did genetic engineering for the purpose of creating a race to do gold mining and to do the hard labor.
But that really is a spin a big spin on an interpretation that only one man ever took, and it's his own interpretation which doesn't stand up with other experts on linguistics.
So you don't think that this finds its origins in...
No,
and
I'll tell you why.
Sumerian.
I mean, Anu in Babylonian and in Sumerian and in Egyptian, Anu, and it's still taught today in the higher mystery schools, Anu was always a spirit. It's the Anu who guides you through the Book of the Dead, through the underworld. It's the Anu who does it. You call up the Anu, and every doorway in Freemasonry has its Anu and its passwords. It's the same thing. And
so
the whole
not a literal being, then?
No. In fact, the Sumerians had the exact same story, really, as the Egyptian, where earth met sky, and out of sky came Uranus and so on, different gods. And these are these had nothing to do with real people. When you look at kingships and the system, they will always give you a hierarchy of mortal beings modeled after a heavenly body sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the multitude of the stars, the holy host, is the multitude of stars. And then you have your main ones, the planets, and those are sections or hierarchies of priesthoods which deal with specific things coming downwards in a V-shape, an upside-down pyramid, to meet on the earth plane. Then you have the upgoing pyramid meeting at the apex, and that's where the king is. And then you have the descending order of nobility, courtiers, military, all the way down to the masses, who are again the earthly host.
Mm-hmm.
This is, so they always justified it with the, what they call foundation myths, and that's how they justified their control system.
Now,
that was standard.
In that model,
mm-hmm.
do we still have groups that are promoting that model?
Oh, yes, it's still the same today. I can remember watching, when I was small, the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II.
Mm-hmm.
And it was astounding to watch, because this was held in Westminster Abbey, an old Middle Age cathedral. And in Westminster Abbey, you have tombs of knights, of the Norman knights that came in about the 11th century. And the Norman nobility are still the nobility today all over Europe. And near where the queen was being coronated, there's a couple of a man and his wife. He's dressed up as a knight, laying flat, of course, on top of the sarcophagus. And next to him, on the whole wall, from the floor to the ceiling, you'll see a chessboard, which is a tesserated floor of Freemasonry, on the wall. And next, on either side of it, there's an obelisk, an Egyptian obelisk. And then there's two tiers above that with another four obelisks, Egyptian obelisks above that. And this is inside a supposed Christian church. And then when the queen was being coronated, she's raised up on a raised dais, like a ziggurat, is a step pyramid. And her throne is there. And then you have all these lords, all the nobility and cousins and relatives. And the lords wear traditionally a red outfit. It used to be a kind of gown,
mm-hmm.
with an ermine collar on it. Ermine is the symbol of royalty in Britain and in Europe. Now, the ermine fur, you'll see on the depictions going as far back as Nimrod. Nimrod wore the same thing, ermine fur, with a red outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're watching this being reenacted thousands and thousands of years later in Westminster Abbey, and then the queen is handed the same symbols, the scepter, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the staff. The guy in front of her, he holds the crook, the archbishop. And of course, you see in the Egyptian petroglyphs, you'll see the hand on your coffins, you'll see that the pharaoh has his arms crossed, and he holds the rod in one hand, which is really a mace, and on the other hand is the small staff. That's the staff or the crook of the shepherd. He was the good shepherd. because all these leaders down through history were called good shepherds. And what you did was cajole the sheep to come this way by pulling them with the hooked end of the crook. And if it didn't come, you hit them with the staff. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. That's in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this odd thing from that was used 5,000 BC, being reenacted in Westminster Cathedral in the 20th century. And everybody who was present stood exactly in the right positions, as you'll see on the various carvings of Nimrod being inaugurated. And no one asks why. Why?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to ask why. But very quickly, let me ask you this. Isn't it true that in the ancient world, in the ancient civilizations, the religion was divided? There was one religion for the nobility, the elite, and another for the peons.
Absolutely.
Before we went to break, you were talking about the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, and everybody standing in their proper place, just as it had been in antiquity, and you said, and nobody stops to ask why. So what is the answer to that? Why?
They don't ask, actually, because the public asks very little, unfortunately. Some children might ask the whys, and the parents can't give them the answers because they don't know how old this tradition is. They assume that it's simply a Middle Age Norman creation, and they don't know the tie-ins to the ancient Babylonian, Sumerian type system. But once you've studied them, it's so apparent. And I have been in Westminster Cathedral too and looked at these incredible the knights there with, as I say, the Egyptian obelisks inside this Christian cathedral. And then, of course, you're onto a hunt just to find out why they're there.
Uh-huh.
And to find out more about these Normans that brought that system with them. Who were the Normans, for instance, to bring in Egyptian obelisks into a place like England? And, of course, there's so much more behind the Normans than meets the eye.
Well, what was the reason that they brought in an Egyptian system?
Well, the Normans are strange people who just sort of popped up in the north of France and supposedly had a connection with the Scandinavian countries and used the Scandinavian countries to come down into England from, at least from one direction, while they had an onslaught through Europe, taking over Europe on the scale of, bigger than the scale of World War II, actually, with logistical supply lines going right back to their little country in France. They had huge forts built, massive forts, pre-built, prefabricated, and they towed them across the English Channel and assembled them, hundreds of these things. And so the supply lines stretched all the way back to the north of France, and no one's ever said, where did all this money come from?
Mm-hmm.
To hire tens of thousands of workers, to hire such massive armies, while the nobility themselves, the Norman nobility, came in with all of these strange Middle Eastern coats of arms. It's never been discussed by the historians as to why. Where did all this backing come from? Where did the expertise come from to begin a war like that, knowing where it wanted to go, and having the financial backing and the military logistical expertise to carry it out?
Have you been able to determine where it came from?
Well, yeah, I think in part ways. When you look at the standards that they had for nobility, now most people will say, well, you know, they copied the standards around the times of the Crusades, and but we're talking about just before the Crusades came in. The Normans came in with these banners, their own family crests. We see some of them up around the Black Sea area prior to that, where people lived.
Mm-hmm.
And a nobility lived. Herodotus mentions them in his writings around 300 BC. And later on, we see them coming to prominence and being called the Khazars by a man who wrote the 13th tribe, Arthur Koestler, or Koestler. And he goes into the history of the 13th tribe. They adopted Judaism around the 7th century AD. But there was two groups of them. One of them, the public seldom saw. They were called the Kagans. They were the nobility of this group. And it's possible that these were actually a people, a nobility that came out of Egypt itself. And very possibly around the time of Akhenaten. Because the only symbol that the Khazars had, according to Maimonides, who's one of the top historians of the era, he lived in Spain, and he helped bring Judaism to them when the king asked. He said that the Khazars, or the Kagans, the kings, were of a red or blonde complexion, and they had blue or green eyes. And they did not mix with the rest of the people, the ordinary people around them. But they had these same types of standards that we eventually became known in Normandy, in the Norman country, and then came into England with. So there's definitely a tie-in there. And they were a very powerful people, a very, very powerful people. They'd helped the Christian church many times. In fact, they saved the Christians, the Vatican, when the Moors were sweeping across. It was the Khazars with their massive military. They had the biggest mounted cavalry in the world at that time. And they prevented the Moors from taking over what was left of the Vatican lands at that time.
Isn't it interesting that a people who had the largest, most powerful cavalry at the time, mm-hmm. and yet there's still so little known about them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know that some of them became popes because they intermarried with the empire, the emperor's daughters and so on. And Pope Leo the Khazar, that was his name in the history books. He was one of the first ones. Other ones moved on through Europe. The nobility, the knighted nobility, they disappear from the scene around the 8th, 9th century. And then you have these people that they're now calling Normans popping up in the north of France, creating this brand new country. And they're no sooner there than they're creating a war. The country, Britain was only taken over in 1066 by them. And with about 40 years, they had recruited so many people there, as they had in all countries which they took over, and they took them back to the Holy Land to get Jerusalem. And they kept these crusades up for a few hundred years.
So the crusades
they didn't know where they were going, yeah.
So the crusades were engineered by the Khazars?
It would seem so, or these people who at least we know called themselves Normans, that is for sure. That is for sure.
Okay, let's go back to Egypt now, because you were saying that all this began when the masters in Egypt, in essence, recruited people like Plato, Socrates, Pythagoras, etc.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who are those masters?
The Egyptian masters themselves always give you a story of being gods. That's traditional. Even King James, the King James Bible, made some quite profound speeches where he said that he represented God, and that was traditional. The higher nobility all claimed descendancies from God, but that's really to fix it in the people's mind that they are a different people than you, and they deserve to be above you. That's how the God thing works, you see.
So,
however, we also know that they do intentionally inbreed, always have done, partially to keep the power and the wealth in their own hands, but also because they've always believed from ancient Egypt down through Greece and onwards that you breed for intellect, and since they thought they were the highest of the intellectual species, they bred with each other.
As a matter of fact, Queen Elizabeth is married to a distant cousin.
Yes, he is. They did. In fact, the present monarchy of England has so many fascinating stories attached to it, because really they came from Prussia and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Philip, his father had taken over a vacant throne that came up in Greece. So he was Prussian, really, and they took it over, and then eventually the Greeks threw them out, and it came to England. But they're all Prussian German, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what they used to be called was interesting. Even Adam Weishaupt, who popped his head up as part, and the only part, I stress, of the Illuminati, and again, revolution once again. When he went for refuge after being found out, he was kept in refuge in two of the landed estates, the princedoms of Germany, by the Saxe and Coburgs. Now, why would royalty that you think Adam Weishaupt was going to overthrow, why would royalty put him up, give him a lifelong pension and security? Why would royalty do that?
I don't know.
And then you find the present Queen of England, their true name is Saxe, Coburg, Gotha. The same ones.
That is their true family name?
Yes, uh-huh.
I had never heard that.
I can check it up. Uh-huh.
I did know that Queen Elizabeth, her great-grandmother is the great-grandmother of Prince Philip.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I knew that, but I didn't know the family name.
Mm-hmm.
Say it again.
It's Saxe, which is S-A-X-E, and that was one of their princedoms for their family. Another part of the family set up another castle, so they called it Coburg, and then they set up another place, and they called that Gotha. So the family's name is Saxe, Coburg, Gotha. That's a real name.
Huh. So. It's the monarchy is not actually of British descent.
That's just it. When you look at the monarchy and the nobility and aristocracy of Europe, that who are all descended from the Normans, none of them ever intermarried with the people they ruled over.
So how far back does this bloodline go?
They'll go back, I'm sure, to the. Well, actually, there's two different stories on that. Depends on who you take.
Mm-hmm.
I know that some of them like to believe they go back to David. You'll find that Prince Charles, in one speech he gave, he said that he could trace his lineage back to Noah.
Oh.
Which, of course, had to be a very high Masonic joke, because they all know what Noah means. But on the other hand, many of these German monarchs bought their monarchies around the 16, 1700s. So it's difficult to tell if these were some of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned they all know what Noah means. What does it mean?
Well, Noah is it's not really just a person, it's a system of those who come between ages.
Uh-huh.
And it's to do with special inbreeding, once again, for select qualities. Mm-hmm. When you read the Old Testament version, and every Masonic lodge has that book there, you know, mm-hmm. because it contains the rules, their rules, in the esoteric form. But you have the only reason that Noah and his family were saved, it said, was because of his he was perfect in all his generations, meaning
yeah.
he'd never outmarried, he'd always inmarried
mm-hmm.
into the same one.
Yeah, it was a bloodline perfection. Alan, how these ancient, I mean, when we talk about this being ancient, we're talking about this going back, way back into the antiquity of Egypt. Does it go back beyond that?
Yeah, we know that Egypt, according to the standard, Egyptologists today, they'll talk about Egypt as being, they can trace it beginning around 5000 BC. But we also know that there were people moving in from the south much earlier than that. Actually, 10,000 BC, there were people moving up that way. And in fact, the Sahara Desert wasn't a desert then. It was full of jungle. And they found elephants, skeletons under the sand, and the tigers, lions, etc. And even the ancient stumps of trees, petrified trees.
Yeah, but so, what about this mystery system? Does it go back beyond Egypt?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the mysteries. When Solon, I mean, we get most of it from the writings, again, of Plato. And Plato talked about an ancestor of his who'd left him the story of Atlantis, of course.
Okay.
And so this distant relative had gone to Egypt maybe 120 years before Plato, and he was discussing with the high priest about how old man was, and the priest said to Solon, this relative, he said, you don't know how old you are, you Greeks. You know, he says, countless civilizations have risen and fallen, risen to great heights and then fallen over many, many thousands of years. So man is far, far older than we have been given with the Darwin stuff, you know, far, far older. And again, he wasn't much different than what we are today. The craniums they're finding, etc., are pretty well the same size. And I think Darwin offset a lot of the historical research. He basically waylaid it to an extent by getting a philosophy across. When you go into the histories of Greece, where they claimed that there was a catastrophe at one time on the planet, where it was possible that a huge meteorite had struck. He said that the elite lived and survived inside Mount Parnassus, and where they had food stored and water for a long time. And the same story is repeated in the histories of the Hindus, who claim they have records of five previous times or ages. We see ages to sort of put into figures we can understand, sort of time zones of 25,000 years or more. Actually, it's millions in the Hindu system. And then we have the likes of Tacitus, who was the royal historian for Nero, who got the Druid story where they had a record of three previous ages. Now, all of them can say the same thing. Armenia is another one. Where we get the biblical story of the ark. I think it's anything to do with the ark. That's a Masonic thing. The ark is the sun as it goes across the sky. That's the covenant. But you'll find that the mountain it supposedly came down on is actually full of tunnels, ancient tunnels. And the Armenians who lived at the bottom of it say that that's where the elite survived a previous catastrophe. So the Druids did the same thing in the mountains of Britain. The Greeks went into Mount Parnassus, and then the northern Indians went into the mountains in the north of India, the Brahmins. And the Brahmins there today still say that they are survivors of the previous man from a previous age. So definitely the world has gone through previous ages, which always leaves it wide open to either was it natural phenomena or was it caused by man in advanced technology. That's always the big question, and authors make a killing at this whole speculation here.
Well,
but we do know that the Egyptians around 2000 BC had records, and the Babylonians had records where Egypt had called in all the wise men from all over, including Babylon, to reset the calendar because something had happened. And now they had a few more days added to the calendar. The old calendar was 360 days. The degrees in the circle, that's where our degree system comes from. and yet you add days to it because the Earth is now revolving slower after some kind of huge meteor hit. And we know that the huge meteors have hit
yes.
in different parts of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if a meteor was to come down, you certainly would have tremendous heat if it was a huge one. And you would have tremendous fire as this hit the sky with almost atomic explosions. You'd have fire which would melt the pole caps, and then it would be followed by massive water collection going up into the sky, and then you'd have rain. So fire followed by water, that's part of the mystical answer to that,
mm-hmm.
fire and water. Because all of those peoples gave the same story of the atmosphere went on fire, followed by tremendous rain, water.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at in my question is, do we know if this system, this mystery system that got exported through Pythagoras and Plato, etc., does it have its origins in Egypt, or did they get it somewhere else?
The Egyptians had to have gotten it from a previous time.
Okay.
It's no different from Sumer. Sumer did not start with some walking reptiles. It's a good story, but they had to convince the public, and this is traditional, you convince the public that they're a lesser, inferior type, and that the royalty are a superior type, they've got more of the genes of the gods. That was standard. And what they said, they always say they're offsprings of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And then the public think, well, we're an inferior type made to be a slave. And if you look into the prayers of the bureaucracies, the bureaucratic classes, the priesthoods who were bureaucrats in Sumer, you find that they had prayers to the god. And the god was the invisible god, you see, of the heavens.
At one point here, I mentioned, and you confirmed, that in ancient times, these occult managers of civilization developed one religion for the elite and another religion for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us just a quick thumbnail sketch of that and why they did that?
It was to bring a slave class up, really, in the belief they were an inferior species, actually, an actual different species. And of course, you tell them that the nobility and all the aristocracy are a higher species, closer to the godhead. That was standard all over the world, really. Right up until Scottish and British kings and queens who believed that they were descended from the gods themselves. Now, Plato went further into the description of this, where he believed their religion at the top was always based on a twofold type of reincarnation, which is different than the one spun out today. The religion at the top was that they were different from the public. This is what they told each other, and Plato went through this, because in sometime in a distant past, they were the rebels who rebelled against the Creator. And because they were cast here, where ordinary people already lived, they arrived with more psychic special powers than the ordinary people. And they created their own bodies from the material at hand by willing it into existence. And only a perfect body could be inhabited by their perfect spirit.
So, in effect, then, they're claiming to be what the rest of the world, the Western world, would refer to as the fallen angels under the command of Lucifer.
That's correct.
They're Luciferians.
Yeah, but you might say Luciferian.
Yeah.
And rebels, they're proud of the term,
mm-hmm.
and that they're behind all revolutions. They claim that once they started to inbreed with the people already here, they began to lose those special powers, and hence the need to go back into the inbreeding program, which is still going on today.
Yeah, the
bloodline. And the priesthoods who take the genealogies.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, your first name, and where are you calling from?
Hi, Kevin. This is Al from New York. I'd like to ask Alan Watt if he could give us a little more information about the tie-in with Freemasonry and Hinduism. And I was reading a book recently, or just started reading a book by David Hatcher, Childress, about called The Nana, Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis. And I was wondering if Alan would talk, if he knows anything about that, if he would talk about that going way back, where did they get this, technology that they wrote in about the Brahmins or the caste systems.
Okay, we'll get him to comment on that. Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, the caste system falls right into this, in effect, because in India, with the same religion of a beginning for the elite body, to do with a special type of reincarnation into perfect bodies, and only the perfect body, you'll find that modern masonry, or what we call modern masonry, is really, in fact, Charles Darwin, when he came out with his theory of evolution, was only on behalf of the Royal Society, that's the scientific, the Royal Chartered Scientific Society of England. He was simply brought forth to put into the public's mind what Masons had already been taught. That was their religion. Evolution was their religion. And they believed that, although they themselves had been made perfect, that through the special selective breeding all down through the ages, they would become once again as the beings they had been in the beginning, these ones that were cast here, but far more perfect, with the same abilities of intellect, command, able to command people, and tremendously fantastic physical bodies. That's what Charles Darwin's theory was. It was nothing more than expanded Freemasonry. In fact, his grandfather had already put a treatise out on selective breeding and evolution before Charles did. Now look at the Charles Darwin family themselves. His great-grandfather, his grandfather, his father, and himself only married one other family, into one other family, and that was the Wedgwood family of England, who were famous for their pottery, a very wealthy family, and that's the only family they ever interbred with for all those generations. Charles himself had 10 children by his wife, who was a Wedgwood, and when she died, and most of the children did die too, and two of them were insane, when she died, he married his mother, a Wedgwood, her sister, his aunt. So they've been going down through the ages interbreeding for special qualities to try and keep up these special qualities. And you can jump back to Plato and say, my goodness, this is the same thing that he was talking about then, 2,300 years ago, selective breeding for special abilities. If you want a good scientist, you get a man and a woman who are very, very good at it, and interbreed them, take their offspring, and match them up with the same over and over again. That's what we're seeing. So the Brahmins of India, we'll enter this in more detail, of course, that man was far older, and they did say, and remember that the Indian upper class is a caste class system, very much like England, by the way. I used to say, my goodness, isn't it so similar to the English system? That the Aryan people think of Germany being the Aryan race, and they got that from theosophy. But the Aryan people, whom the Brahmins are proudly descended from, were a pure white race. Again, light hair, blue eyes, etc., who came into India, some say around 500 BC, I think it was much earlier, and they lorded over different parts of India. They were told not to interbreed with the Dravidian, the darker race there. Over time they did, and you end up with this caste system. So your color literally designated your position in society, right down to the darker ones who are now called the untouchables. So you had a fixed society. The Brahmins ensured they were taught reincarnation at all levels of society and karma, so that you could train people to believe, well, that's your position in life, accept it. You must be bad in your last one to end up as an untouchable or a slave or a peasant.
And if you do very good and you behave where you are now, then you may come back in a higher caste.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is also true that they have, in the old Vedas, drawings of what appear to be aircraft. A lot has been made of it. We just don't know if this is early ancient technology.
Well, it's also in Egypt.
Yes, in Egypt, too.
Yeah,
and of course, even the BBC had a documentary years ago on the lead acid batteries that were found in Egypt, which are now in the Cairo Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And they have lead and copper plates in them. And the man said, watch this. He poured in the battery acid, connected two wires to a bulb, and sure enough, it lit up. He says, this has no other function than being an electric battery.
Mm-hmm.
So they had electricity.
Yeah.
And they found those batteries now in Babylon as well, or Persia.
Yeah,
or Iraq.
Well, I'm familiar with some in Damascus. Also, in Abydos, in a temple there, one of some carvings up on the frieze show very clearly what looks like a helicopter, perhaps a jet, but certainly some type of aircraft with wings and a rudder. It also shows something that looks very much like what we would call a flying saucer. And these were carved thousands of years ago.
Yeah. Well, a lot, you see, of deceit and deception, too, has crept in with sensationalism from the times of Erich von Däniken, who actually had a little guy in Mexico carve a lot of these things out for him. And a reporter from Britain found this little guy who was getting 5 pesos per piece. And that's when von Däniken hit the dust. However, he put out a lot of disinformation about the spaceships. He said, now, the thing about the flying saucers is just a globe with wings, and that's the traditional way
not,
that even...
Not in Abydos. Not in Abydos.
Well, I mean, I've seen the Vedas. I've seen the Vedas, and the Vedas, too, do more descriptions about what existed more so than drawings. And they show, they said that the gods, now the gods, remember, were your kings, the hierarchy, they were always called gods. They said that they fought each other in a big battle towards the end of the last age, and they could fly, they had flying machines, and they shot different colored rays or lights at each other.
Yeah.
The red one would burn anyone wearing metal, just like microwave, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these odd things being discussed.
Well, also now you're talking about the ancient writings there in India, in the Mahabharata.
Mm-hmm.
There is a description of something that if I just take that description and show it to someone, don't tell them where it's from, don't tell them it's part of an ancient Indian epic, and they read it and I ask what does that describe? They will say, that describes a thermonuclear blast.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that there has been found in Rajasthan a site of a thermonuclear blast in strata from 12,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so some of these things may be real.
Maybe real, although we know they can also be caused by very high velocity meteors coming in. It's when you get the description of them coming in.
Yeah, but it's a different type of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different type of radiation and different rate of decay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is, to date, there has been no real comment or any kind of debunking of this site?
No. Even though there are many clues, still less than regular history. And it's up to the individual to decide. I mean, we can get carried away, obviously.
Sure we can.
By limited information. Limited information sells a lot of books. That's why the authors jump on it and take them off. We do know that the ancient Greeks, who learned everything again in Egypt, started the atomist theory, the atom theory, back around 300 BC, 400 BC. And they had the atomic schools, we call them. And they're well documented. We've got records of it all. And they knew that you had tiny whirling bits of matter. And they said that the atom was not the smallest part of matter.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, we always suspected this, but just found out for sure in the 20th century. Now, it's impossible for men living thousands of years ago, I don't care how much leisure time they had, and how many slaves did all their work for them to give them this leisure. I don't care. If you didn't have the scientific knowledge and the equipment to go after what you're talking about, you could never have dreamed up the atom.
So what are you saying? Are you saying that they had the technology?
They had to have.
Uh-huh.
They had to have. There's no way a person with limited understanding of physics, no microscopes and atomic microscopes, etc., could break down the content or even dream of the content of hard matter. They understood perceptions and how they differ from angles of stance to the object and so on. But they knew that nothing was technically solid, and that if these atoms could be made to vibrate at a certain speed, you could put a man or a chair through a wall without injury. So they knew this stuff.
This is from 300 BC?
Yeah.
Okay. That's not so far back. I mean, at that stage of history, we dig up a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we've not, as far as I know, archaeologists have not recovered any of this high technology for looking at atoms and so forth. Is it possible that instead of them discovering this, that they were told this, perhaps, by beings from off-world?
I don't think so. I think there have been many ages where a few come through with the knowledge and never share it with the vast majority. Power is kept by the limitation of knowledge by a few, because knowledge is power. And if man, if it's true that they've gone through at least five definite and two possibly more ages in India, in the Indian records, then man is millions of years old. You can imagine the knowledge that was accumulated during that time.